Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. I mentioned earlier that different kind of freedom summer, black Democrats may have helped Mississippi Congressman Thad Conkren yesterday survive his Republican primary against a Tea Party challenger, blacks and other Democrats. Conkren had appealed to Democrats, at least his campaign had, to show up and do just that. Democrats could cross party lines under Mississippi election law. We'll talk to Jason Riley now from the Wall Street Journal editorial board about what may have been strange racial bedfellows in this Mississippi primary. And we'll talk about Riley's new book called Please Stop Helping Us, How Liberals Make It Harder for Blacks to Succeed. Maybe you know his last book, Let Them In, The Case for Open Borders. So we'll touch on that, too. Not many conservatives are for that, as Eric Cantor may want to testify today. Hi, Jason Riley. Welcome to WNYC.
Thank you for having me.
And let's begin with the news. From what you've been reading, did black Democrats help a very conservative Mississippi Republican keep his seat in the United States Senate?
I'm skeptical to what extent that happened. To me, if you're a Democrat, you wanted the Tea Party candidate to win, not Conkren, who would be much more difficult to beat in the general election. So I don't know. I don't give that theory too much.
And, we often hear these conspiracy theories, not so much about the campaigns themselves, but, and people were selling this after the Eric Cantor race, that Democrats voluntarily showed up in that primary to sabotage the powerful majority leader, not because they supported his Tea Party challenger, but precisely for the reason that you say, a Tea Party candidate would be weaker in the general election. Mm-hmm. There are races where, you know, Republicans have allegedly done this too. I think it's rarely, if ever, been true. But I wonder if this is different because in Mississippi, the Republican is likely to win this Senate race no matter what.
Well, in the Cantor race, one thing that gave that theory legs is that someone explicitly did that. A former opponent of Cantor publicly encouraged Democrats to do this. So that gave that theory a little more credibility, I think, up in Virginia versus down here, where, like you said, the Republican's going to win. If you're a Democrat, you want the weakest Republican, and McDaniel was clearly seen as the weaker.
Or if the Republican is going to win in November anyway, maybe you want the less extreme Republican if you're a Democrat. And here's Conkren speaking last night, and some people have interpreted this as a little bit of code thanking those people who cross party lines.
You are the ones who helped reach all the voters, make sure that we knew that they were important to this election because it's a group effort, it's not a solo. And so we all have a right to be proud of our state tonight. Thank you very much.
So he's talking to his core supporters at his headquarters. You are the ones who did what? Who reached out and made sure that they knew that it was a group effort, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, I'm someone who would like to see more black outreach from the GOP. So if Conkren's going to lead the way, great. I'm very happy for him for doing that. But the problem is you don't see a lot of Republican outreach to the black community these days. And I talk about that some in this book. And I think I don't ascribe racial animus to it. I think Republicans know they can still win elections without the black vote. And until that changes, I don't expect to see a lot of black outreach. You have some talk in the GOP about Hispanic outreach now because some are worried maybe we can't win elections going forward unless we dip into this voting block some more. But there are really no such discussions happening about black voters in the GOP.
Jason Riley from the Wall Street Journal editorial board, author of Please Stop Helping Us, How Liberals Make It Harder for Blacks to Succeed. And your basic arguments in Please Stop Helping Us are classic. Welfare causes dependency, not success. The minimum wage increases low-skill unemployment. School privatization helps poor families escape failing public schools. Affirmative action makes it harder for blacks to succeed in colleges they're not really qualified for. And we can talk about the merits of any of those, but are you adding a new wrinkle to these perennial debates or mostly restating them?
I am talking about the evidence we have over the past 50 years that these programs, these efforts to help are not only not helping, but often doing more harm than good. And I thought that the occasion of Obama's presidency was the right one to take on this issue, because so many on the left have made political power a priority for helping blacks. And I wanted to say, okay, now that we've crossed that, let's look back and see whether all the efforts that were put in to producing a Barack Obama by the black left have paid off in terms of how underprivileged blacks are doing, because all this was ultimately done in their name.
Can you measure that when so many policies that Obama may want to institute in domestic terms have been blocked by Congress?
Well, I think you can look back at history, at the money that has been spent on these programs, and look at the track record of their success. You know, the poverty rate was lower in 1966 than it was in 2012. After $20 trillion of Great Society programs thrown at the problem. The black incarceration rate was lower in 1960 than it is today. Was there more racism in 1960?
And people can argue whether that's from market forces that are being not sufficiently ameliorated by government policy, or whether that's the result of government policy.
Well, I think the government is helping in the wrong way. Ultimately, the book argues that black culture is something that needs to be confronted head on, that blacks need to develop the types of behaviors and habits and attitudes that other groups had to develop in order to rise in this country. And a government program, however well-intentioned, that interferes with that self-development ultimately does more harm than good. And you mentioned affirmative action. I think that is a perfect example, a well-intentioned policy put in place 40-odd years ago to help increase the black professions, the ranks of the middle class, black college graduates. Yet when California ended racial preferences in higher education back in 1996, black college graduation rates went up by more than 50%, including in the more difficult fields of math and science. So after 40 years of this social engineering, we had in fact produced fewer black doctors and lawyers and engineers and mathematicians than we otherwise would have.
And I don't know if other people will argue with those numbers, but would you say that there should be any kind of affirmative action? We've had several African-American author guests recently arguing that, yes, there should be affirmative action, but by class, not race, so that the black children who grow up in privileged households, don't get the benefits of affirmative action. But it would still help a lot of African-Americans who might otherwise be overlooked by the educational system.
I think that would just be a different form of social engineering, and I don't know where the evidence is that it would be helpful. When you look back at black elites coming out of the Civil War era and into Reconstruction and so forth, this debate was going on. Frederick Douglass said, the great abolitionist said, everyone's asking me, what are we supposed to do with blacks? And he said, do nothing with us. If we can't stand on our own, let us fall. I just want the opportunity to stand on our own. And Booker T. Washington picked up the same theme. He said these rights and privileges should be ours, but it's much more important that we be prepared to take advantage of those rights and privileges once they come. And we haven't been prepared to do that, and that is the problem.
Listeners, and first preference for African-American listeners to have this conversation with Jason Riley.
That's affirmative action, Brian.
Well, no, that's relevancy to the issue. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. And obviously, Jason's is a minority position within the black community, politically speaking, but let's have this dialogue. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. I see your face.
Well, it's a minority opinion within the black community if you allow the black elites to speak for the black community. If you think Jesse Jackson and Al Sharpton and the NAACP speak for most blacks on these issues, then yes, it's a minority position.
Or I could judge by the fact that 90% of blacks vote for Democrats in most elections where, kind of traditional liberal versus traditional conservative policies.
Well, but
being
if
compared.
You poll blacks on things like school choice, for decades.
School choice is a tough one. That's
for
where
decades,
that's one,
the
that
black
one
poor
down.
Have supported them, and the black elites have not. If you even poll affirmative action, and ask people about racial preferences. The black elites come out on one side, and the black masses come out on another side. So on a number of these issues, you have this disconnect between what the NAACP right. types are saying and what black people and the black poor in particular want.
There certainly
busing was another example. This goes back decades. The black elites wanted kids bused to better schools and in different neighborhoods. The black poor did not want that. And the black elites' kids were not on those buses.
but you go much further. I mean, you know, you've said in an interview that your case for no minimum wage laws is one of the two most important in your book.
Yes. Oh, yes. The minimum wage law is sold as an anti-poverty measure. But most poor people already make more than the minimum wage. And most people who make the minimum wage are not poor. And so to the extent that you are pricing people out of the labor market, you are keeping them poor. Most poor households in America are poor households because no one in the home is working, not because the people who are working in the home make minimum wage. So to the extent that you are reducing job opportunities for people through the minimum wage, you're not helping to alleviate poverty.
But the idea that there should be some kind of social contract for people who work when the market won't provide them a living wage, the idea that civil society or democracy should guarantee a decent social contract for working people, mm-hmm. do you oppose that idea?
No, you're talking about a safety net, which I support. But
I'm not talking about a safety net. I'm not talking about a safety net, which would be for the unemployed or those incapable of working. I'm talking about a social contract for people who do work full time.
Well, I think that the problem that the black underclass has is a culture of dependency, and that what they have become is addicted to these handouts. And you talk about black loyalty to the Democratic Party. One thing behind that is that the Democrats are the party of bigger government, and you have an overdependence of blacks on government, whether it's in terms of jobs, the post office, the military, and so forth, or in terms of handouts, welfare, food stamps, and so forth. You have dependency on government, and therefore you have black allegiance to a party that believes in bigger government. But that dependency, I think, is doing more harm than good in the long run. And one of the points
But
I
there
make,
are two things. I want right. to push you on this, because isn't there a difference between dependency on government programs and, you know, people will argue various sides of whatever, food stamps, whatever, but and the kind of things that regulates the market, which is not a government handout, as you use that word. For example, here's Mayor de Blasio yesterday mm-hmm. as he was convening other mayors on the issue of inequality.
If we don't get to the root cause, which is wage levels and benefits levels, we're kidding ourselves.
Wage levels and benefit levels. So he's talking about government regulation of the private sector, not government handouts, to make sure that when the market does not create a level playing field in terms of worker power and employer power, that the government, the civil society, provides some kind of decent social contract, for example, minimum wage.
Well, how are you defining the lack of a level playing field? I mean, that's what it comes down to. And what de Blasio does is define it in terms of outcomes. And when he finds unequal outcomes, he assumes something is wrong in terms of opportunity. And I don't agree with that. And you don't find equal outcomes anywhere in human history. You do not have these direct proportional
right.
rates of people in the professions and people in certain skills and people in physics and mathematics and Nobel Prize winners. You don't have that anywhere. And to make that your definition of whether or not equal opportunity exists, I think is very problematic.
But we live in a globalized economy with large amounts of automation, tremendous depressing market forces on wages, these two things, globalization and automation, tremendous drivers of imbalance of bargaining power between workers and owners. Do you disagree with that analysis? And then do you just say, well, you know, that's the market. There's going to be winners and losers. If what we have in the real world is the market forces pushing down middle class wages closer to poverty wages and poverty wages below what would be the minimum wage if the market by itself were able to rule?
Well, those forces are affecting everyone who lives in this country.
Correct.
The question is why they have the impact they have on black Americans. That's what I'm talking about. in the book, and why blacks fare worse than others. That's the question. Why is that? And my argument is that it's because blacks have not developed the attitudes and behaviors, the cultural, what economists call human capital, necessary to move forward in this country. And to the extent that the government has tried to help them, it's interfered with the development of those qualities. I mean, at a 30,000-foot level, I think that the marketplace, as a free market person, does a better job of allocating resources than Mayor de Blasio would do or any individual would do. So I think the outcomes, I think the marketplace does produces better outcomes than we'd have otherwise, even if those outcomes aren't perfect. But the bottom line for blacks is that, particularly the black underclass, is that it's much more important to have a black man in the home than a black man in the White House. That's the bottom line. And the left doesn't want to talk about the cultural barriers to black success. They want to talk about white behavior and its impact on black behavior.
Here's a
and
clip.
I'm saying that's not where the focus should be.
Jason Riley, our guest, Wall Street Journal editorial board member and author of Please Stop Helping Us, How Liberals Make It Harder for Blacks to Succeed. I want to play a soundbite of Ta-Nehisi Coates from this program recently, the Atlantic Magazine writer who recently put out a widely shared piece called The Case for Reparations. And here's a little bit of his case that you have to look way beyond the racism in people's hearts or cultural factors to look at the sources of inequality today.
We imagine it as a disease of the heart, when in fact the most damaging aspect of white supremacy and of racism in this country has always been a disease of the wallet, and that is the taking of African of the possessions of African Americans, doing enslavement, the literal taking of the fruits of labor from black people. And this taking doesn't end with slavery; it proceeds in out into the Jim Crow era. It proceeds, you know, in terms of taking African American tax dollars and promulgating a public university. University system, for instance, that African Americans aren't allowed to use, barring African Americans from the vote, and thus, you know, barring them from any ability to have any sort of say in how their tax dollars are used. The point here is plunder. It's not, you know, necessarily the disease of the heart.
Well, you look at black outcomes before the Great Society began in terms of black labor participation rates, the black family, illegitimacy rates, marriage rates, and so forth, two-parent households. You go down the list, and you see better outcomes 50, 60 years ago than you find today. You cannot argue that there was less white supremacy, less racism 50 or 60 years ago. So the idea that is the key, that remains the main barrier to blacks rising socioeconomically, it's just hard to fathom. I found the piece very interesting because he spends most of it complaining about programs that haven't worked. He goes back to, you know, Reconstruction and talks about the New Deal. He talks about Great Society. And all of this doesn't work. And what does he conclude? We need another big government wealth redistribution program called reparations, and that will get it done. And I don't know why he's so confident that that will happen, given the track record he's just described.
We're already over time. Let me get a couple of calls in for you. Lamar in Huntington, you're on WNYC with Jason Riley. Hi, Lamar.
Hey, Brian. How are you?
Okay.
Love your show.
Thank you.
Just a couple of things. The first thing, like that, I always, and I'm a professor at a university. I teach public policy, and I'm also not a Republican, not even close. But the one thing that always bothers me about a lot of conservatives, whenever they talk about issues in the black community, it always goes back to culture. And it really kind of puts me off, and it puts a lot of other people that I know of color who are educated off, because it makes it seem like black people are just pathological in some ways. And if you go, and I've traveled to poor white communities and everything else, and you see the same exact quote-unquote cultural problems. And I feel like the biggest issue with dealing with poverty is the whole notion that it's an American problem. It's not just a black problem. You see illiteracy, you see out-of-wedlock births, you see people not working, you see people dependent on welfare, and you see it in these poor white communities in Appalachia and everywhere else. So that's my biggest concern. And secondly, if I can get in something real quick.
Hang on, Lamar, because the cultural question is so huge, and it sounds like it's central to your argument, Jason, yes?
Oh, it's quite central to the argument. I don't think until the black family gets its act together, until fathers are raising children, the influence of the father in the home, the bad outcomes associated with absent fathers, from the chances of you being involved in the crime, in the criminal justice system, graduating from high school, but let alone college,
teen pregnancy, just
down the list.
But other people would say this isn't just bad men have black men have black men have bad hearts and souls, but that there are all these economic forces.
I'll give you an example of trying to make so many
men not marriageable as women see them.
But I'm talking about what the government is doing in terms of social programs. We were talking about de Blasio earlier. De Blasio wants to cut work requirements for receiving welfare benefits for adults, able-bodied adults, reversing what was put in place under Giuliani and Bloomberg. Open-ended welfare policies do not encourage a group to develop a work ethic. They do not encourage responsible parenting. These are efforts put out there on the left, seen as sympathetic, caring, and conservatives who don't like them are cold-hearted. The question is, what is the end result? What are the incentives being put in place? And I don't think open-ended welfare benefits help blacks.
And there we leave it for today, and I hope you'll come back. Wall Street Journal editorial board member Jason Riley, his new book, Please Stop Helping Us, How Liberals Make It Harder for Blacks to Succeed. Thank you very much.
Thank you.